The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 110. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, one of my favorite individuals to interview. He needs no introduction whatsoever. His name is Jeff Snyder. Jeff, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me back, George. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, now I know that whenever you do a podcast with our mutual friend, Emil Kalinowski, he is a wordsmith, to say the least. He always has these really cool names for you that he starts off like the Batman of the bond market, or I don't know how he comes up with these. But one thing I need you to promise me, ask Emil if he can start referring to me as the Vince McMahon of macro.
Vince, I like it. You know, all you have to do is pay him, because that's what I do. I pay him a particularly significant stipend, and he definitely comes up with those names for me.
Okay, only he can do it. So I'll have to get the stamp of approval from him on the Vince McMahon of macro thing. You know, I'm gathering all these macro experts and putting him in the ring to duke it out. But I was listening to a couple of your most recent podcasts on the Making Sense show, which is, if you're not subscribing to that, viewer or listener, make sure you go to YouTube or iTunes and subscribe right away. But it's Making Sense Euro Dollar University. And one of the more recent podcasts, you guys started talking about the yield curve control and what the Fed's been referring to. And you've got some very interesting opinions on this, such as they can say they're doing it, but the market might do it for them. And then you had some interesting insights going back to the 1940s, the last time they tried this yield curve control. And there was inflation, but you said it was kind of transitory. It wasn't really permanent. There's a lot of nuance there that I'd like to dive into.
Sure. And I think what I say is a lot more abrupt and blunt, is that there's absolutely no need for yield caps or yield curve control, because, you know, the only reason you would use that kind of a program is if the bond market, it's particularly the treasury market, is in danger of selling off in any significant fashion, something worse than 1994, for example. And that's just not the case. And in fact, you know, every time that we see these yield caps imposed, or at least announced to the world, they're really not needed. It's central bankers trying to do something else by making you think they're important and central in the bond market.
Yeah. So how do you reconcile that with a chart that I saw the other day? And I'm probably just not connecting the dots properly, but this chart showed the Fed's treasury purchases recently relative to the rest of the world. And you just see it's basically the Fed's balance sheet, it just goes parabolic. And the rest of the world who's buying these treasuries pretty much flat. So if the Fed wasn't there buying those treasuries, would the yield spike? And if not, why?
Has it spiked since they stopped buying treasury? I mean, yeah, they bought treasuries, but they're buying treasuries, number one, to expand their balance sheet so they can create bank reserves as a remainder.
Right.
So that's really what's going on with the Fed. And number two, if the Fed wasn't buying those treasuries, who's to say nobody else would? And that's really the implicit assumption behind the idea that yield caps are needed. It's the idea that, hey, if the Fed wasn't there to do it, then nobody else would buy these things, and then the treasury market would fall apart and interest rates would skyrocket, and it would be a disaster for everyone everywhere. The way they tell it, the biggest danger to the world today is rising interest rates, which is, you know, pardon my French here, complete horseshit.
Yeah. Well, see, I fall victim to that myself, because when I see that chart, I think to myself, my gosh, the Fed is creating all this excess demand and therefore increasing the price, lowering the yield. But what you're saying is they're not although they're buying it, they're not necessarily creating extra demand.
No, look at the price of all the treasuries. Look at the yields are today. You know, the Fed has cut back the pace of its purchases significantly since middle of May. And here we are almost 2 months later, and yields are where they are. They're lower than they were before. The U.S. government, despite the fact that auction levels have been greatly increased, has absolutely no trouble selling its debt, whether the Fed is buying, whether the Fed isn't buying. And that's really the point here. The Fed isn't the independent variable in this equation. It's demand for treasuries outside of the Fed, which prices, yields, markets are showing that it's a persistent bid. And by the way, look, I mean, George, we heard all this stuff before, not that long ago, 11 years ago in 2009. Ben Bernanke, without Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing, then, you know, the reckless Obama administration was going to blow up the treasury market. And that never happened either. Look at what happened to the bond market and yields post-2009. You know, the private banking system around the world had absolutely no trouble absorbing what was back then taken to be this enormous, massive, unbelievable increase in government debt. And it was absorbed perfectly and easily simply because the conditions behind all of these things hasn't changed. We're still in the deflationary circumstances where the demand for the safest, most liquid instruments is going to be high no matter what the supply is.
Yeah, and you know what I'm not considering, Jeff, that you just made me realize when I look at that chart, is I'm not considering the supply side of the equation. I'm just looking at the demand side of the equation, or how much the Fed was buying prior to May, but I'm not thinking about all the additional treasuries that are being sold at auction because of these deficits they've been running.
Yeah, you've had record auction amounts, par values auctioned at the middle of the curve, the front end, the back end, everywhere. And you know, some of the middle curve numbers, they're record low. The 10-year, not that long ago, record low auction yield. So the demand for treasuries is there whether or not the Fed buys them too. And again, the Fed isn't buying treasuries to support the treasury market. They might think that's a benefit of doing so, but their big concern is bank reserves, creating reserves on the other side, which means they have to buy something. That's why they're buying mortgage bonds, for example. There's no housing crisis. There's no mortgage bubble crisis. The reason they're buying mortgage bonds is because they have to buy something. So the Fed is buying assets, and it doesn't really tell you that much about the demand for those assets apart from what the Fed is doing bureaucratically.
Yeah, but what's going through their head? Because, I mean, I was looking at excess reserves the other day, and I mean, how much is enough if you're the Fed? It's gone from, what, I think $1.5 trillion up to like $3.5 trillion? Do we need to get to $10 trillion before there's enough excess bank reserves? Or what's going through their mind?
Now you're speaking Japanese. Really, I mean, we've learned absolutely nothing from, and I say we, they've learned absolutely nothing from the Japanese example. The Japanese have gone through this exercise for the last 20 years, and it's always, okay, what's the right amount of bank reserves that will fix our problem? And you know what the answer is? No amount of bank reserves will fix their problem because bank reserves are not the problem. They're not the solution. Right. So no matter how many bank reserves the Fed creates, it won't make much of a difference. The problem is this. Is the private monetary system, not the public input into that monetary system.
Yeah, and Jeff, on that note, I've been trying to get my mind around the bank reserves don't have a causal effect with the broad money supply. And I totally understand that, but what happens, I look at a chart of the Fed's balance sheet, and then I look at a chart of M2, and it
right
seems
there's your
like,
problem,
recent...
George.
okay. Where's my problem? Where am I making a mistake there?
M2 was obsolete as a concept 60 years ago. M2 doesn't really describe the money supply.
Let me make a note of that, so I'm not using that in my videos from now on.
M1, M2, all of those. You know, the Federal Reserve undertook a project to try to update the M numbers in 1960. By 1971, 1972, 1973, they realized it was pointless. They couldn't keep up with monetary evolution. So by 1974, they were already saying, look, M1 and M2, don't use them. We don't use them because they're worthless. They don't tell us anything. They're not comprehensive enough, and they're not complete pictures of the effective money supply in the actual monetary system. So that's your problem. You look at M1 or M2, and you see the Fed adding to it, and you think, well, the money supply went up. Well, no. The only thing that changed was M1 and M2, which means nothing. It means very little. So once you realize, don't look at M1 or M2 because they're misleading you, which, by the way, the Fed is actually hoping happens, then there's really not much of a problem because what the Fed does, what the really does in reality outside of these M statistics is they're trying to coax and nurture some kind of a rebound in the private monetary system outside of the M's that you can't observe. There are no statistics for real effective money today. So we really don't have any idea what money supply is doing, except by when the monetary system has these tremendous effects on the markets that we do observe, like the treasury curve, for example. If there's you know, uninterrupted massive demand for treasury securities, we can infer from that that the banking system, therefore the monetary system, is looking at that monetary system we don't see and thinking, I need to hold the safest, most liquid instruments. And you're not going to hold the safest, most liquid instruments if you think the Fed is being successful in creating money and that there will be plentiful money and inflation and economic growth ahead. You do it because of the exact opposite.
Okay, so let's go back to that, because I remember on a podcast you saying that you're kind of in the Friedman camp, that you see inflation as a monetary phenomenon. And I hopefully I'm not putting words in your mouth there. But if so, then if M2 is just kind of, like my accountant used to say with QuickBooks, to use some more French, since I'm here in St. Bart's, that you say dog shit in, dog shit out, right? So
<Exactly. laughs>
if M2 is dog shit in, then if we're trying to figure out, what the monetary, not the monetary base, but the broad money is, so we can figure out if we're in risk of inflation. And if inflation is a monetary phenomenon, you're saying the only way to really measure that is we have to infer it through the yield curve?
Through the yield curves or Eurodollar futures, money curves, the way the dollar behaves, any number of financial markets, because the participants, the financial agents that are the big players in those markets are the monetary system. It's a bank. The Eurodollar system is a bank-centered system. So if the banks are moving these various markets around in a specific fashion, they're telling you what's going on in the monetary system. It's not direct communication such as that we would like from, these bright dividing statistics that, M1, M2, M3, whatever it might be. But we can reasonably infer from all of these markets and how they co-behave and correlate what the banking system is actually doing, and therefore trying to tell you about the real conditions in the monetary system that have nothing to do with what Jay Powell and the bank reserves are doing. In fact, again, I think you started to make the point. Once you realize this, what you see is that the level of bank reserves is a reactive phenomenon to what's going on in that hidden system. That's why, for example, I showed recently, the dollar went up in value in the same direction that the level of bank reserves did. And then since the middle of May, the dollar has been somewhat lower, while the level of effective bank reserves has been lower too. So there's a direct relationship between the direction of the dollar and the level of bank reserves, which is the opposite way it's supposed to be, right? If the Fed is printing so much money, why isn't the dollar pushed low while it's printing money? And the Fed is pulling money out of the system, as it's supposedly been doing since the middle of May, with lower level of bank reserves, why is the dollar not higher? And the answer is because bank reserves don't really matter. They just show you what the Fed is doing, not what the system is doing.
Right. And so we know the system, the commercial banking system, creates money supply. Does the government also create money supply in the real economy when they spend it with the Fed monetizes it? Do they create additional deposits?
No, not at all. I mean, the Fed is just doing what it always does. And the Treasury Department is doing what it always does. It's simply doing it to a much greater degree these days. The Treasury General account, for example, that's something that's been around for a long time. It was never used before 2008. So it's not like they're adding money supply. In fact, when the balance in the Treasury General account goes up, they're actually subtracting bank reserves from use from banks. So, the Fed isn't creating money and giving the Treasury isn't making money.
I'm saying let's use the TGA as an example. If it's at $1.6 trillion, if they spent that all into the economy, just did stimulus checks as an example, like unemployment, wouldn't that increase the amount of deposits in the economy, in the banking system, as bank reserves?
Right, but it's not an addition. It's offsetting, hopefully, offsetting what has already been taken away. You think about what's going on in the economy right now. We have massive amount, trillions upon trillions of lost income, lost revenue, lost profits, lost investment that the government is hopefully trying to offset by doing what you said, which are these stimulus checks. which are nothing more than, you know, limited levels of replacing or offsetting what's already been lost. So they're not adding anything to a system. They're trying to fill in what is already a gigantic hole.
And that hole is a result of a destruction of credit, or just a destruction of loan from people paying back debt and not taking out more debt.
It's a result of both things. It's the destruction of money in the system, which is what we saw in March, the first half of March, as well as economic destruction as a result of trying to shut everything down completely all across the world. I mean, that's an unbelievable level of economic destruction, deflationary destruction, that, you know, the government is just simply hoping that they can buy enough time to keep everything at minimal levels so that we don't run into the second and third order effects that will hamper and probably impede the recovery. It hopefully happens sometime before the middle of the decade.
Right. Okay. So let's just say that lending and the amount of credit in the system was equal, that it didn't change. And the TGA fills up to a trillion. So they're taking deposits. So they're taking deposits out of the system. And then when they spend it, they're just spending those deposits back into the system as well as the bank reserves. And so that's why the net effect really hasn't changed as far as the amount of deposits in the system.
Exactly. And really, that's the point, is that, you know, when you look at it from a Fed perspective, it looks like you're adding. But when you look at it as a comprehensive perspective, you're just switching one for the other. You're just moving stuff around.
Okay, let's move on here. I don't want to get too fixated on that topic. So when you're talking about deflation, Jeff, I think people put you in that camp. How are you defining that? Because when I hear people talk about inflation, deflation, it seems as though they just take this broad stroke approach, and there's a lot of nuance there that people miss. As an example, people think deflation, therefore they think the dollar is automatically going up on the DXY, that the prices of goods and services are going down, and asset prices are going down. But what I've seen throughout the 1970s is a good example of that, is the CPI asset prices can be moving in different directions. And more recently, I've seen where the CPI and the dollar can be moving in different directions. So how do you define deflation?
Well, first of all, I'm not in the deflation camp. I'm looking at the way the world actually is, and the evidence is putting me pushing me in that direction. So, you know, I'm not a deflationist or an inflationist. If I see things turn around, I'll become the quickest inflationist you've ever seen. So, I mean, it's really what the markets are telling us, what the economy is telling us, and what they're all pointing to is deflationary pressures. And you're right, George. We have to be very specific about what we're talking about, because deflation itself actually means something specific. And I'm as guilty as anyone for using it too broadly to describe exactly the stuff that you're talking about. But if we're talking about specifically monetary deflation, it's not strictly the opposite of monetary inflation. There are specific effects that monetary deflation have. If you go back to, say, for example, the early 1930s, that obvious monetary deflation, what that did to the economy was, because there was a shortage of money, it meant that consumers and businesses and all sorts of economic participants had to liquidate their own assets. Consumers, they had to sell their own furniture just so that they had enough cash to buy groceries, for example. And what that does is it drives the price of everything downward. Because if everybody's trying to liquidate their own assets, not only does it drive the price of stuff down, it undercuts the profitability of production itself, which is the true insidious part of deflation, which means that when prices get forced so low because of monetary shortage, your businesses only lose money whenever they produce, no matter how much they produce. And the only way that businesses can respond to that situation is, as John Maynard Keynes said in the 1920s, they have to start cutting wages, or it results in mass unemployment. So specifically, monetary deflation ends up being mostly a labor market phenomena. So when you see mass unemployment and you see widespread wage cuts, which doesn't really happen as much anymore, but it does happen in certain circumstances, those are symptoms of monetary deflation. And that's what we're really seeing ongoing right now across a lot of the world. It's not specifically asset markets. It's not specifically what the dollar is saying or the treasury curve or things like that. But we're seeing massive levels of labor market destruction that, you know, we haven't seen since the 1930s.
In my mind, and maybe I'm not seeing it correctly, but that when we're talking about unemployment going through the roof, we're talking about the demand side of the equation. what if the government comes in with just this limitless UBI, let's call it, to pump up demand? I mean, I remember, I think I was talking to Lynn Alden, and she was saying that over the past couple of months, that average incomes in the United States have actually gone up because people are making more money on unemployment. So, I mean, even if unemployment goes, let's say 20-25% like it was in the 1930s, if the government is just giving out all these stimulus checks, does it affect demand? And if it doesn't, is that still deflationary when we could see the supply side of the equation shrinking a lot faster?
Now, you have to go back and think about Friedman in the 1970s talking about, you know, not just rational expectations, but the permanent income hypothesis, which says that if consumers or business or workers or whoever are getting stimulus checks, they will adjust if they're temporary. If they're temporary, they might splurge, but then they'll still be cautious and they'll still pull back spending. So what you might end up getting is a temporary surge in spending and income, but consumers are not stupid. They know that the checks are going to run out, and they're going to prepare for the day when the checks run out. And the way that they prepare for that day is by increasing their saving, which ends up being harmful toward economic activity. So, you know, a temporary increase in stimulus is really, again, only intended to buy time for the private economy, the regular economy, to come back and provide consumers again with regular income, permanent income, that they can then count on to go back to the way they used to be before. And what happens, especially nowadays, what we're seeing is that, yeah, the government has come in with and flooded the place with all of these stimulus checks, unemployment, the helicopter payments that came out, you know, a couple months ago. But yet consumers know that these are one-time things, or they're temporary stimulus measures. And so they've already started saving. We see it in consumer credit. We see it in the savings numbers. Consumers are already adjusting their behavior because, look, I mean, they have to be realistic about what the labor market actually is. So even if you're not one of the unfortunate workers who have lost a job, you could still have a job, but be worried that you might be next on the unemployment line. That's going to change your behavior. You're going to react to that by acting very differently. It's going to reduce aggregate demand throughout the economy.
Okay. Is there a point where that psychology changes if the government says that they're going to make this more permanent? Or is there a barrier to them making it more permanent?
Is government payments under a UBI the same as a job? That's really the question. Is it a good enough substitute where a consumer says, I used to be working and I used to get X number of dollars. Now I'm not working, but the government's going to pay me X number of dollars. Are those things actually equivalent? Do they make a difference in terms of behavior? And I would argue that the UBI or anything like that, while possibly a marginally useful substitute, is not a substitute for a robust labor market. Because a robust labor market isn't just X level of income. It's opportunity. It's the promise of greater and growing levels of income. It's a dynamic marketplace where it allows consumers to act in the way that the economy needs them to act. They can be reasonably assured that they're going to have, you know, not just what they make today, but some kind of better future for themselves, and they'll act accordingly. That loosens the proclivity to spend.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So when we're talking about the destructions of deflation earlier in the 1930s and what Keynes was talking about, how should I look at the deflation that we had in the late 1800s, where we had, and from what I've seen, obviously the data is sparse to say the least, but from what I see, you've got like maybe a 2-3% deflation, but then you've got GDP up in nominal terms. You've got wages up in nominal terms. You've got interest rates around 4% nominal. It seemed like although we had deflation, we had a pretty strong economy. So is that a different type of deflation, or am I reading the numbers incorrectly? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about a couple things there, starting with the fact that economists have argued over whether the Long Depression actually existed or not. And the Long Depression was really supposedly a result of the United States going back on the gold standard after the Civil War, reimposing fixed money supply at pre-war parity and retiring all the, you know, the greenbacks that were issued to pay for the Civil War. And, you know, I don't think there's really been a satisfactory agreement. I mean, both camps have really dug in pretty hard on their own respective positions, because there simply isn't enough data to say for sure which one was the right one. Contemporary sources refer to it as a boom, while some actually do call it a long depression. So even you know, what what limited view we have of the situation on the ground back then, there really isn't an agreement as to what actually happened. And of course, the end result of the Long Depression was silver agitation, which suggests that maybe there was something to it, you know, that maybe the money supply needed to be loosened because it was too tight. But the other point here is, I think the more important point is that there are different kinds of deflation. Monetary deflation, as we described it before, ends up destroying the labor market. Productive deflation, as we've experienced throughout our history, throughout the history of, you know, the post-Enlightenment period, is not the same thing at all. Productive deflation is what capitalism brings through the mass production of goods.
Right.
It's essentially that we get better about producing things, innovations, combining capital with labor in more efficient ways that allow us to produce more and better and you know, products and services that increase the level of living standards by reducing the prices for a large majority of the population. So productive deflation is not at all the same thing as monetary deflation. In fact, we expect productive deflation as sort of our background behind everything. So, you know, we have to be careful about making sure that we're talking about one or the other, not both at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So wouldn't that really kind of shine a light on the Fed trying to create this crazy 2% inflation target, if that's still their target, where we could have the economy improving, to your point, if we had the productive deflation, but then they're sitting there fighting this productive deflation, heaven forbid prices go down so consumers get a break, with more whatever they're trying to do to create inflation. Aren't those at odds?
Yeah, and far be it for me to argue the point for central bankers, but what they're actually saying is that, look, we can't tell the difference in a short-run scenario between productive deflation and monetary deflation. So therefore, okay, what central banks intend to do is to add actually invite a modest level of positive inflation to act as a cushion so that central bankers have enough time to sort out which is which. So that we have, you know, sort of what they talk about is altitude. We have a little of inflationary altitude between inflation and outright monetary deflation, so the central bank can have time to get its act together to forestall the worst kind of the monetary deflation. That's really all it is. Central banks and economists, because they can't sort out one from the other, it's incredibly difficult to do, especially in a real-time basis. That's really what inflation targets are all about, targeting a little bit of positive inflation to get people to expect a little bit of positive inflation as a cushion against monetary deflation that is hard to spot. At least that's the theory. You know, I'm not arguing for it. That's just what's behind the monetary policy objectives.
What's your opinion of the CPI and how accurate or inaccurate it is?
I think it has limited use. I think it's pretty inaccurate, and that it's, you know, in some ways it's a you know, a quixotic quest that's not really worth the trouble. However, as I've pointed out recently, it does seem to correspond with certain time periods that make it at least somewhat useful. I'm talking about the core CPI, the seasonally adjusted core CPI, which only tends to fall during these very obvious economic shortfalls, contractions, recessions, the worst recessions, as a matter of fact. So, you know, there's limited use to the CPI, but overall, I think especially on the inflationary side, you know, you have to take it with, you know, as one element in a broader survey. Is it being confirmed by, for example, the bond market? So if you see the CPI run up, is the bond market responding as if the CPI is actually telling you something specific? And which brings us back, you know, we talked about before the 1940s, that's really what happened in the 40s, especially, 1947, 1948, when the European economy started to open up and the U.S. economy demobilized. It created this massive supply shock, which pushed the CPI up to, I think, about 12-13% in the back half of 1947, which, I mean, 13%. Yes. I mean, it sounds like the 70s.
Jeff, I'm sorry to cut you off right there, but I just want to point out to everyone that 90% of the people or economists out there, I would think, would attribute the inflation to the yield curve control that the Fed did. But you're saying that's not true. It was actually a supply shock that did it.
No, I'm pretty sure the literature, the academic literature from the Federal Reserve, agrees with my view of it too. Fed economists, the academic papers that have been written, it's pretty clear that it was a supply shock, not a monetary shock. However, at the time, the Federal Reserve was worried about unwinding its yield cap, that in doing so, combined with a supply shock, it might become an inflationary environment. So a temporary supply shock burst of inflation, they thought was in danger of becoming out of control inflation like we saw in the 70s. And so the Fed reacted to that by trying to reimpose the yield cap on bonds when it really didn't need to, because as opposed to the CPI being double digits, bond yields didn't really move all that much. In fact, you know, the ones that aren't capped, private corporate bond yields move basically, you know, 50 to 60 basis points in a year and a half. Hardly the kind of signal you would expect from the bond market if inflation was imminently not just breaking out, but to become a sustained phenomenon. So the bond market was saying, we see the 12% CPI, but we're not buying it as anything more than a temporary thing, which, by the way, was proven exactly correct, because within a year, the Federal Reserve was selling those bonds that it bought back to the marketplace because demand had come become overwhelming again, and yields fell as the economy fell into recession in 48 and 49.
Okay. Got it. That makes sense. So earlier in the conversation, we talked about you really not being in the deflationist camp. You're just kind of calling it like you see it. What would make you change your mind and say, you know what, things have changed, XYZ has changed, therefore I think we're going to get some consumer price inflation moving forward? What would need to happen for Jeff Snyder to have that view?
I think we'd need to revamp the entire system. I don't think that, short of that, I don't think we're going to see. I mean, you would see the change in the behavior of the way the curves work. I mean, if there was any kind of realistic possibility with the system we have now, which I don't think is possible, but, you know, I could be wrong. If we were starting to see a nascent inflationary environment start to develop, you'd see it in the curves, and you wouldn't see it, you know, it wouldn't come out of the blue. I mean, you would see it. You know, they would start to take different shapes. They would move in different ways. You'd see corroborating activity in the dollar and certain other things where you would look at it and broadly think that, okay, something has really changed here.
And then I want to, and I'm jumping all around here, but I'm trying to fill in the gaps in my head. So when we talked about M2 really being kind of bogus, and if I'm not mistaken, they use M2 to try to figure out what velocity is. So is it safe to assume that velocity, the charts that I'm seeing on the Fred website, are just as bad as M2?
The concept of velocity is even worse. I mean, velocity is not something that you can observe, or it's inferred from an equation of exchange, which has never been proven as a valid equation. So essentially what you have is a tautology. M times V is whatever M times V is, because M times V is always whatever M times V is. It's really that meaningless. So what you see is M2 go way up. And because velocity is not a real concept and it's simply a remainder in equation, velocity necessarily has to fall, because that's what really happens. It's not really describing anything meaningful or real. It's just it's a meaningless equation that people use because, well, people use it. It's never been proven to be an equation. And therefore, again, velocity is nothing more than a tautology.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Next question here, and this is a video that I'm working on currently. Let's just say, and I know this is probably unrealistic, but whatever the probabilities are, and well, it's at least very unrealistic short term, but longer term, let's say the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. So if that, if we could just wave the magic wand and boom, boom, the dollar's no longer seen as this, you know, global reserve currency, what happens to the U.S. economy?
Well, I don't think I buy the premise of the question, because the one doesn't necessarily follow the other. You can't just wave a wand and the dollar is no longer value. You know, the dollar is no longer reserve currency.
A better way to ask the question is we talk about exorbitant privilege, right? So what types of exorbitant privilege has the United States had since Bretton Woods that people would understand just looking at the economy as it exists today?
I'm not sure it's an exorbitant privilege. I think it's an exorbitant burden. But, okay, you know, I think really you can't realistically expect to go from A exactly to B. In other words, whatever the next reserve currency regime is going to be, there's going to be a transition phase. And we shouldn't automatically assume that because the dollar might be replaced, that it will be bad for the U.S. economy. I mean, yeah, okay, so we don't price oil in U.S. dollars anymore. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Well, it could be if you're, you know, specifically benefiting from that arrangement. But we have to look at, in terms of the entire systemic process, is that by moving to a reserve currency regime that actually works, it might unlock other areas of growth that are previously unappreciated. We might have an economic boom in industries and areas that we don't have now. So it might be that we move from a reserve currency. It's not harmful to the U.S. It's beneficial to everyone. And so that's why, you know, I'm not rejecting necessarily your premise. I think that we have to think about these things in a more comprehensive fashion, because, you know, the way things are now with the U.S. dollar unofficially officially the reserve currency, the euro dollar the actual reserve currency, and that it doesn't work, and it's causing all this economic disruption and dysfunction, that just ditching, you know, the system as it is now and transitioning this to anything else, almost anything else, might be better for everyone.
Well, that's an interesting take. Yeah, I was looking at it more on surface level, just thinking, okay, over the last, whatever, 40, 50 years, we've probably had lower interest rates, which would mean maybe higher home prices and, you know, maybe higher stock prices. The dollar has been, call it maybe artificially overvalued relative to other currencies because there's more demand for it outside the U.S. economy. Therefore, how does that trickle down throughout the domestic economy? That's kind of what I was trying to think through. But your point, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that although there may be some downside, there may be some upside that we don't even know about that would act as a counterbalance.
I would even go one further, George. I would say that if we had a better reserve currency regime instituted in the 60s and 70s when it should have been, then we might have had better quality growth this entire time. We might have had interest rates where they are, housing prices where they are, but no bubbles, no credit growth. We might have had a better quality of economy and economic trends leading up to 2007, 2008, such that 2007 and 2008 never happened. So, you know, again, that's why I say, you know, the reserve currency system as it was might have been a burden, not a benefit. And that's, I think we need to think along these lines, that if doing something differently isn't necessarily mean that it causes somebody harm. It changes things. And there will definitely be winners and losers. But broadly speaking, to do something right should create a system where there's more winners than losers, and that the losers eventually become winners if given enough time. I think that would have been the case had we done the reserve currency system right in the 60s and 70s, rather than what was called benign neglect, which was, hey, let's just let this Eurodollar thing run rampant, which it did. Rather than do that, to do something more inherently stable and sound, we might have had a better, you know, the 1990s are supposed to be this, you know, apex of economic growth, this level of prosperity that we should aim to, but it might have been even better. It might have been more sustainable, which was what we were told in the 90s, was that this new economy promise was supposed to continue that kind of economic environment rather than just end it. So, you know, I think there's more to the story than that.
What would have made the system better? You talk about going back to Bretton Woods, and that if the system would have been different, maybe it would have been better. But what specifically would have made the euro dollar system better? And then maybe we can backtrack and kind of help the viewers and listeners understand how the Bretton Woods system brought on the birth of the euro dollar system, and then take that through 2008 and the whole thing being broken.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question, because I think, you know, first of all, the Bretton Woods system was, the pendulum swung way too far to the other direction, which was we had this background behind it, which was, you know, globalizing economy, tremendous amount of innovation that wanted to be unlocked. You had the destruction of World War II, all of these things that combined to where we needed a reserve currency to function, to allow this globalization, this trend globally to happen, this positive trend that was a benefit to everyone around the world, which required an amount of currency that the U.S. couldn't supply under the Bretton Woods standards, which was to make U.S. dollar, physical currency, U.S. dollars convertible into gold, which was limited. But the reason that we had that convertibility, the reason it was limited by gold, was because you needed to inject some kind of discipline onto the system, so that it wouldn't get out of its original mission, which was to supply currency to provide this grease to the wheel, so to speak. And so the Bretton Woods system was too restrictive. It didn't supply enough currency to the rest of the world so that it could fluidly continue down this path to globalization and increase trade. And what the Eurodollar system was, it threw off the restrictions of gold and went in the complete opposite direction, to where there was no restraint, there was no discipline at all. It simply just became, especially in the 90s and 2000s, it became the object just was simply to get bigger, 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 no matter how insane you did it. And so what we want to do is find somewhere in the middle where we preserve the aspects of discipline, rigidity, and some elements of the Bretton Woods system that keeps the banking system essentially honest. And honest is probably too much of a word, but you know what I'm saying? It's, you know, we're not just funding any kind of speculative insanity that's out there, because you at least know that if I do something wrong, I might be out of business. Some kind of brutal capitalistic free market discipline needs to be imposed.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like free market capitalism there, Jeff. Be careful what you wish for, right?
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's really historically what made especially the classical gold standard work the best, was that, you know, businesses and banking institutions, in the most part, in the majority, they had to be more honest and more realistic about what they did, because they knew at the end of the day, they could be out of business. And that's what was really missing in the Eurodollar system, especially under benign neglect, was, you know, too big to fail. Those prospects that, hey, if we screw up, who cares? No, you know, we'll get bailed out, or, you know, it won't make any difference because somebody else, there's more than enough money out there that somebody will fund our stupid ideas for as long as we need them to. And so we need to go back to somewhere in the middle where we have some level of discipline, but yet able to supply enough monetary currency that the system is not too constrained and held back, which is what we've seen since 2007 and 2008, because the pendulum swung way too far in the other direction again. It's almost like we're back to the Great Depression era, where the monetary system is a drag on everything rather than a tool to allow economic growth to happen and to happen in a sustainable fashion.
Yeah, see, but that, what's crazy about that argument, Jeff, is it sounds very much like an MMT type of argument, where, you know, that's kind of their thing, is that we should just allow the powers of fiat currency to unleash the growth potential of the U.S. economy as this sovereign nation that can print its own money. I know that's not what you're saying.
A really good point, though. It does sound like it's a similar thing, but there's a huge, huge difference. The difference is the MMTers are saying that decision about the money supply and the level of monetary resources systemically should be made by some enlightened philosopher sitting in some central bank office somewhere, who is, tops, you know, down, has all of this, you know, computer screens all over and is monitoring the system and supposedly under this technocratic ideal, which is unrealistic. It's not going to happen. You're not going to have one person be able to make enough of a right decision for, and I hate to use the term right, but enough of a decision to create a stable equilibrium for the most complex dynamic economy that humans have ever seen. You know, by the way, that economy is no longer a national economy. It's a global economy with all of these different parts and pieces that are always moving, that never stand still. It's a completely dynamic marketplace. And so, no, the MMTers are saying that a bureaucratic committee in a room, and they'll decide what the right about level of money is for the economy. I mean, it's complete crap. I mean, the Federal Reserve has been, you know, central banks, modern central banks have supposedly been that ideal for this long. And they show you time and again that it's impossible because they screw up and screw up and screw up. That's all they ever do. What I'm saying is that we regulate the money supply, not we. The money supply is regulated by decentralized processes, the markets. The markets tell you when there's enough money, when there's not enough money.
I want to just unpack that a little bit further, because you talk about how it's just totally unrealistic and it's actually damaging to have this tops-down approach. And you hear people like me throw out words all the time, like malinvestment, misallocation of resources, there's no price signals. How do those, and moral hazard as well, so how do those play into this top-down approach or the central banks trying to micromanage the economy through psychology or however they try to do it?
Well, they're necessary consequences to that approach, aren't they? I mean, really, you can't have the central top-down approach without them. Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, that's the entire purpose of the central approach, is to say there will be no downside. We'll keep things running along an optimal path. And that's really the fatal conceit here, is that the proponents of this type of economic management always believe that using the right formula or the right level of I mean, the right series of data and the right combined in the right way through the magic of some, you know, perfect algorithm will determine what the optimal path is. And what we realize, what you're just talking about, is, you know, a brutal discipline, what Schumpeter called creative destruction, is that nobody has any idea what optimal is. We don't know what it is. And there are times when, you know, real science and real economy and free markets, these are trial and error processes. They're not somewhere you can just pick in a room and say growth needs to be this much this year, this much next year. It's a trial and error process. And that means we have to let things fail. That means we have to let people try to experiment and do, you know, sometimes stupid things, if for no other reason to become an example for other people and what not to do. So it's not as simple as just, hey, looking at a bunch of data and thinking this is the right course. We have to start from the understanding. Again, going back to Adam Smith, the invisible hand, we don't really know what the optimal outcome is because there is no such thing.
Right. And how do price signals play into that, Jeff, as far as making it easier for the capitalists of the free market approach compared to making it harder for the tops down approach? And is that why like communist Russia failed, was they didn't have price signals and there's no price discovery?
No, well, taking the last one first, you know, that's not why Russia failed. I mean, it was part of it, but that's not, I mean, that's a more intense discussion. But you're right. Price signals are a huge part of the capitalist doctrine because they tell you, they give you a signal, hey, don't do this, or yes, do more of this. That's what really prices are. If the prices of something, you know, somebody figures out something really good and starts making a ton of money, you know, the price signal should say, hey, we need more of this. Let's have more people do that. And if the price signal is, hey, this guy's an idiot, it has a really stupid product and is doing something really wrong, then that shows everybody else, hey, don't do that. And so from a systemic position,
and don't allocate scarce resources to that.
Right. It tells you, hey, this is how we operate more efficiently, by avoiding the bad ideas and, you know, following the people who have good ones. And if you're a top-down management, your idea of good and bad might not really be good and bad. It's just your idea of good and bad. And so the economy gets caught up sometimes in these loops where it doesn't really know good from bad. And sometimes we reward more bad than good. And that's an inefficient way of doing things.
Yeah, like the bailouts in 2008.
Exactly. I mean, 2008 was a perfect time to have this, you know, this conversation about a new reserve currency. Instead, the government said, no, we're just going to try to go back to the way things were, as if they had any idea why that was bad or good. You know, it was just, we need to preserve the status quo because, hey, the status quo has us on top of it, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. At the end of the day, with the politicians, it's all about power, unfortunately. What we're talking about here, Jeff, is very kind of, I would call it Austrian, I guess. And I don't know if you've ever, or if I've ever heard you answer this question. Would you put yourself in any specific camp as far as a school of thought, or is it a lot like the inflation deflation where you just call it as you see it? Would you say I'm more of an Austrian, Keynesian, monetarist? What do you think?
I'm not a strict ideological observer through any school. I've taken good ideas from all of them. I think the Austrians on Mel investment have it perfectly right. I think the monetarists, especially the interest rate fallacy, that has it correct. I think there's something, you know, people hate it when you say, oh, John Maynard Keynes is the worst ever. No, I think there's a lot of Keynes that people should read and should appreciate. There's even a lot that Karl Marx said. Yeah, I would even go so far as to say Karl Marx. I mean, some of his critiques of capitalism, you should understand what he was saying and why he was saying those things. I think it's a mistake to put yourself in one ideological camp. It's easy to try to, you know, because it's easier for somebody to provide you with a worldview that's already prepackaged for you to then start trying to interpret things. But I think if you're really honest about what you're trying to do, you should be free and open to all, because they all have really good ideas. And I think they're pragmatic ideas, and sometimes they're really relevant to the situation. And if you start, you know, rejecting ideas because they have the wrong label on them, oh, it's Keynesian, I can't possibly listen to that, you're doing yourself a very big disservice.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's why I love to have just a variety of people on the show and talk to them, whether I quote unquote agree with them or not, just to improve my own thinking. I know you've been very generous with your time, Jeff. We're about 50 minutes into this. So I want to make sure that I hit a topic that I've heard you talk to Emil about in several of your most recent podcasts, which, again, I want to give you a plug there. You guys, you have to follow Jeff and Emil. Their podcast is Making Sense Euro Dollar University. You can find it on iTunes, I believe, and definitely on the YouTube channel, the Alhambra YouTube channel. But you guys were talking about Marxism, and I actually, when you did the first show on it, it was kind of off topic for you guys, and it just blew me away. I was in Medellin listening to it, and I had to listen to it like two or three times just to absorb everything, but it was so fascinating. So I don't want to give away the punchline. Can you walk us through what you guys talked about on that podcast briefly, and then what you've talked about, I think, in an additional podcast, and how it's so important, especially in today's day and age, where the buzzword is late-stage capitalism, that proponents of free market capitalism, such as myself and such as yourself and Emil, should really need to understand the Marxist view of the world today?
Yeah, well, it may have sounded like it was out of the blue for us, but I've been writing about this trend toward socialism for many, 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 many years, because I've seen it coming. And, you know, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I think what really, I spent time reading through what the socialists actually believe. And, you know, you could kind of see that, hey, you know, it's not the hardcore revolutionaries that we necessarily have to worry about. It's the fact that they've been able to attract supporters and sympathizers who may not know exactly what they're supporting and sympathizing with. Because the economy over the last dozen years has fed into these narratives. And what those narratives are, just to put it quite simply, you know, I'm going to oversimplify here, is what Karl Marx actually said was, communism does not compete with capitalism. Communism replaces it. The capitalists provide a useful service to the communists by creating, through what we just talked about, all these wonderful technologies, industrialization that was unlocked through the capitalist, you know, environment, the free market way of doing things. And what the communists said was that eventually, because capitalists had to exploit workers in order to achieve this mass production marvel, that eventually they would run out of workers to exploit. That's late stage or end stage capitalism. The level of inequality between the capitalist and its workers would become so great that would become the signal for the revolutionaries to transition from a capitalist, you know, end stage capitalism that had exhausted itself to the socialist revolution, true communism, which is where all of that wonderful technology is expropriated by the workers and therefore, you know, redistributed amongst according to everyone's needs. You know, the famous doctrine from everyone's ability to each according to his needs. And so that was really that's really the point. And the Marxists have said all along that they're just waiting for this period when capitalism exhausts itself, and that will be the trigger for the socialist upheaval, which begins the revolution and the redistribution of all the property and process. And they thought they had seen it in the 1930s, but, you know, then, of course, that didn't actually happen. And so they've been waiting for Marx to be proven right. They constantly say, you know, Marx wasn't wrong. He was just early. So here we are after the post-2008 environment, and it seems like, damn it, maybe he was right.
Yeah, but what's really fascinating, in addition to what you were just talking about, is everything that has happened since 2008 that you and I would associate with a lack of capitalism, they associate with capitalism, such as the bailouts in 2008 that we were referring to. They see that as, oh, see, there you go. It's capitalism. They're you know, the Fed's bailing out the capitalists. Or with the
wealth
worse,
gap. It's like, well, see, it's, that just proves its end stage, because they have to bail out the banks because capitalism has failed. It plays right into their narratives. The stock market is another one.
Also the boom and bust, because if I'm not mistaken, I saw another video that I incorporated into a white video based on your guys' podcast, but they see this as, once the capitalist squeezes the worker so much that they've exhausted all their buyers, they can't increase profits, then the only thing they can do is take their wealth and put it into financial assets, which creates boom and bust cycles. So, you know, they see these crashes, stock market, the housing crash, and again, it plays right into their narrative.
Yeah, it's essentially that you've impoverished your workers as much as you possibly can, and that's it. There's nothing else you can do except try to hold it together with a bunch of jerry-rigged, you know, unstable financial, whatever, government force, you know, corrupt police state, whatever it is, you know, whatever the Marxists, you know, attribute to your ability to stay in power, is that once capitalism reaches its final stages, that's what happens. That the capitalists will do everything to remain in their power, and it no longer provides the benefits to society, which is why we trigger the socialist revolution to more equitably redistribute all of the property and benefits and technology. That's what they're saying. And everything that's happened since 2008 plays right into that narrative.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but they have like a sense of urgency, because in their minds, if they don't steal the means of production away from the capitalists ASAP, the capitalist is going to make society worse and worse and worse. They're basically going to destroy what they built unless we, the communists, go in and save them from themselves as quickly as possible, using whatever means necessary.
There are certain Marxist strains of thought that believe that, and there are others that don't think so. I think the ones that believe it more are trying to create the sense of urgency rather than there being an actual sense of urgency. Because remember, that's really what's going on here. I think most of the people who you might survey and say they're sympathetic to socialism don't really know what they're being sympathetic about. They just see that the economy of the last 12 years sucks. It really hasn't boomed. And oh, by the way, I remember in college my Marxist professor talking about late-stage capitalism and describing it, and it really seems like everything I see around me is consistent with what the Marxists have been saying, not what Jay Powell and Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke have been saying. And so, you know, that the revolutionaries, their ranks have been swelled by sympathizers who think that the Marxists have been prescient about what's going on. And the common arguments that people, you know, pro-capitalist people deploy is, well, you know, don't these whining crybabies know how good they have it? And what the Marxists say is, well, yeah, we know. That's the whole point. Marx said capitalism creates wealth. And so, yeah, we know how good we have it. Now that you've created all this wealth for us, we're going to take it from you.
Yeah. And then also, too, going back to the rebuttal that most people have and why they don't take Marxism seriously, is because, well, just look at what happened to Russia, look at everywhere socialism or communism has been tried. It's obvious that it's failed. But you had some insight to this that I think is incredibly important, and I'll have you expand on it. But I remember in the podcast, you're saying that the Chinese sent people or economists into Russia once it failed, I believe in the early 90s, and their takeaway from that trip was not that communism had failed, but that they just tried it too soon. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think most pure ideological Marxists agree with that, because what Karl Marx actually said, I mean, if Marx had been alive in 1917 when the Russians did their communist revolution, he would have been abhorred. He would have said, no, this is not what you're supposed to do. In fact, the Russians under Lenin and some of the Menshevik leaders had a tremendous amount of debate about whether or not they should proceed with the revolution, because what Marx said was, you need a capitalist industrialist economy in order to transition into a socialist economy, right? Otherwise, what's the point? You have to let the capitalists create all this wealth and wonderful technology. Otherwise, when you do, if you transition to from a pre-industrial society, you won't have any technology to run your perfect
communism. No wealth to take.
Right. So that's, you know, Marx said we don't want a revolution in Russia or China. We want revolutions in the West. We want revolution in Germany and England and the United States. That's where these revolutions need to start. And what happened in the 20th century was that communism, revolutions and communism were all the wrong places. They went all to the pre-industrial societies. And so the hardcore Marxists say, well, communism didn't fail. It was never tried where it was supposed to have been tried. And so what the Russians did, and then the Chinese eventually after 1949 did, was they tried to make up for that deficiency by jumping, what they realized, they jumped the gun and imposed a socialist system upon, a quasi-socialist system upon a society and economy that wasn't ready for communism. And so they tried to deal with it by, you know, inducing sometimes capitalist reforms. You know, 1921, for example, the National Economic Plan under Lenin was essentially capitalism in Soviet Russia. You were right, point at the early 1990s, you know, Deng Xiaoping, his southern tour was in January of 1992. Well, the Soviet hardliner communists initiated their failed coup in August of 1991, and Gorbachev was out later that year. I mean, you know, these things are all related together. And what it really says is that, you know, the hardcore socialists say, well, yeah, socialism has never really been tried. It's never been instituted where it's supposed to be instituted, which is right here in the United States or throughout Europe. And so you think you're making an argument by saying, hey, socialism has always failed. And what they're saying is, yeah, well, Marx said the same thing.
Yeah, again, it just feeds into their narrative. Like, they're like, duh, we know.
Exactly. Everything you're saying is like, we know that our professors told us this in college. And you have, and what you're really supposed to be answering for is, you know, why is Jay Powell always wrong? He's supposed to be the template or the talisman for capitalism. You know, he's our perfect representative of what capitalism is supposed to be, and the guy's clueless.
Yeah. So, but then on this Marxist thing, you also, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you feel as though that's why maybe the Chinese now are taking a more hardline approach to how they handle areas like Hong Kong, because maybe they're seeing that capitalism has run its course as well. And I'm not saying that it has, I'm just saying through their lens of the world.
Yeah, I think, well, there's one contradictory thing to it. And it depends on how you view Xi Jinping and his view of socialism. But there's no doubt that the 19th Party Congress, which was held in October of 2017, they basically said, yeah, we've ridden our capitalist, our post-Southern Tour 1992 market reform agenda as far as it will go. So in, you know, October 2017, they basically said our experiment with capitalism has reached its end stage. And so what do we do from here? Now, traditional hardcore Marxist ideology says you're supposed to allow the majority to come in, which is the third of the represents under Deng Xiaoping, which was that, okay, we've reached end stage capitalism. Now we transition into the pure socialist communist ideal, which is less authoritarian because the workers are so happy to have everything redistributed to them. But that's not what Xi has done. Xi has gone the other way. He said, yes, I think we've reached the end of our capitalist road here, but he's become more authoritarian, not less. And so it's a little bit of a, you know, contradiction there, where the pure socialist doctrine says they're supposed to do one thing and he's doing the exact opposite. Which I think tells me that, you know, yeah, he might believe it's end stage capitalism, but that might not necessarily mean for China what it's supposed to mean in, under, you know, traditional Marxist doctrine. I think what he's saying is we need the rest of the world to transition before we do. And that's where it gets really interesting and perhaps dangerous.
Yeah, or just, what is it, absolute power corrupts absolutely? Type thing, you know, he gets in power and he's like, well, I've kind of changed my mind a little bit. I like this power thing.
Yeah, there's always that, right? I mean, dictators don't like, you know, handing over their powers of dictators. And that's, you know, it's one of the theoretical problems with communism, right? Because the Marxists say that you have to go through a capitalist democracy stage, but then you have to take, you know, to take off, you know, get past that capitalist democracy stage, you need authoritarian group of revolutionaries, an elite core of revolutionaries to implement through authoritarian means this transition into socialism. What we know from human behavior is that the authoritarians, once they reach the apex of power, don't like giving power back to anyone, let alone the people. It doesn't matter how committed they are in ideology. What they'll say is, oh, well, we're not ready yet. And then tomorrow, oh, we're not ready yet. Oh, we're not ready to hand over power yet. You know, they can keep it going forever. That's one of the problems that, you know, with the Russian Revolution is that Joseph Stalin, of course, kept saying, ah, we're not ready yet. I'm going to continue to be the supreme dictator for a little bit longer, just a little bit.
Yeah, it's just the thing with Marxism, it just, or socialism, it requires people, human beings, to not be hardwired at all. Like it requires that hardwiring to be malleable. And I just don't think it is. I think we're hardwired the way we are, and it's just never going to change. I think the question that most people, at least Americans, are asking themselves right now, Jeff, and we'll kind of end with this one, is we understand what the Marxist view is. We see this kind of playing out in the United States as far as its popularity, and it's kind of the core with the riots and the looting we've seen. It's a little different on surface level, and I don't want to dive into that, but at its core, you know, if you see kind of how they speak, the words they use, it is very Marxist. So will socialism win out in the United States? If you had to make a prediction, what do you think?
No, I'm long-term optimistic. I don't think socialism wins out because I think people are more realistic. And once the Marxists show you who they are, there's something about them that is, as you were just saying, that the human evolution has hardwired to reject. And really what you think about it, Marxism requires an evolutionary step in humanity to become exactly, you know, this robotic, you know, everybody is the same and we all dress the same. We all live the same. I mean, that's not how people are hardwired. And so, you know, there's a social component to Marxism too, that I don't think that people will accept, even if they might be sympathetic to the idea of, you know, when people say, we talk about, oh, we're going to do the economy more equitably, we're going to redistribute goods more equitably. That sounds like it could be a good thing, especially given the last 13 years of lack of economic growth. I mean, you could be sympathetic to that kind of argument, but when we start moving towards it, you know, starting to put, you know, pen to paper and say, what does that really mean? I think people are smart enough to realize, or at least, you know, emotionally invested enough to realize that this is not what they signed up for, at least not what they were sympathetic about. And I actually believe that at some point we'll get the economy growing again, just like we did in the 50s and 60s, and that will take care of a lot of the sympathy. Once you have real economic growth and opportunity, that's what refutes the Marxist argument. That's what effectively refuted it in the 40s and 50s and 60s, was once the economy gets going again, then you say, see, it wasn't end-stage capitalism. There isn't a limit to the future. There isn't a limit to the amount of wealth capitalism create, because human innovation will not be bottled except for these temporary periods where it takes a bit of a detour.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a great place to end. We'll end on a positive note. I like that a lot. So, Jeff, what an amazing conversation. Every time I talk to you, buddy, it just totally blows my mind. So, I know we've mentioned your podcast with Emil Kalinowski a couple times, but tell all the viewers and listeners where they can find out more about what you do.
Yeah, I'm at Alhambra Investments, which is a registered investment advisor. They can find me. I post, you know, a couple times a day at alhambrapartners.com. And we're working on, with Emil and a couple other people, this something we call Eurodollar University, the podcast being the first step, which we hope to be a more comprehensive reference library and list to help people understand and interpret some of these things that we're talking about, you know, yield curve and Eurodollar futures, tight money, all this kind of stuff. So it's available for people to make their own decisions, their own informed decisions about what's really going on in the world.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. Can't wait to do it again.
Thanks, George. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.